depression is when your neighbor loses his job. A depression is when you lose yours. And recovery is when Jimmy Carter loses his. The crowds loved it, and it became one of his most oft-quoted lines. You had to hand it to Reagan. Even though President Carter wasn't actually the one who'd corrected his economics, and even though the first two clauses of the punchline were an old joke by Harry Truman, Reagan had spun the episode into a funny and powerful campaign story. What attracted me to Reagan was the clarity of his conservatism. There was another line he often used on the stump. Government exists to protect us from each other. Where government has gone beyond its limits is in deciding to protect us from ourselves. A man who talks in such terms is clear on what he believes. Very rarely in those days would you find conservatives who didn't fudge on social issues. But Reagan's kind of conservatism was to say that tough love is good for the individual and good for society. That proposition starts with a judgment about human nature. If it's accurate, then it implies much less government support for the downtrodden. Yet mainstream Republicans were conflicted about thinking or talking in such terms because they seemed contrary to Judeo-Christian values, not Reagan. Like Milton Friedman and other early libertarians, he never gave the impression he was trying to be on both sides of the issue. It's not that there wasn't sympathy for people who, through no fault of their own, find themselves in dire straits, nor would you find any less personal willingness than among liberals personally to assist the downtrodden. But that wasn't government's role, according to Reagan. Tough love, in the long run, is love. A little later in the campaign, they put me on the plane with Reagan for a cross-country flight. I was given a very specific task. The presidential debates were approaching, and the governor's top aides were concerned about criticism that Reagan sometimes seemed oblivious of facts. Martin Anderson asked if I would use a cross-country flight to brief the candidate thoroughly, not just on the economy, but on all the significant domestic issues. "He knows you were a good advisor to Ford," Marty told me. "He'll listen to you." When I agreed, Marty pulled out a briefing book and handed it to me. It was a binder labeled Domestic Policy that must have been half an inch thick. He said, "Just make sure you get through every topic." I studied up on the material, and later that day, when we got on the flight, Reagan's staffers sat me at a table facing the governor, with Marty by his side. I noticed that they'd helpfully provided copies of the binder, one for each of us. But Reagan was in an expansive mood, and by the time the plane took off, he was asking friendly questions about Milton Friedman and other people we knew in common. The conversation blossomed from there. I think I heard more clever stories during that flight than in any other five-hour period in my life. Marty kept shooting me glances, but I couldn't get Reagan to open the briefing book. I tried a few times to steer the conversation that way, and then gave up. After we landed, I said, "Thank you, Governor. That was a very enjoyable trip." And Reagan said, "Oh, I know Marty doesn't like the fact that I didn't crack a book." His temperament fascinated me. He brought a sunniness and benevolence to the presidency that never wavered, even when he had to deal with a dysfunctional economy and the global danger of nuclear war. Stored in his head must have been 400 stories and one-liners. While most of them were humorous, he was able to tap them instantly to communicate politics or policy. It was an odd form of intelligence, and he used it to transform the country's self-image. Under Reagan, Americans went from believing they were a former great power to regaining their self-confidence. His stories sometimes had an edge. He told one on the airplane that seemed particularly meant for me. It started with Leonid Brezhnev on the reviewing stand at Lenin's tomb, surrounded by underlings, watching the May Day parade. The Soviet Union's full military might is there on display. First come battalions of elite troops, impressive soldiers, all 6'2", marching in absolute lockstep. Right behind them are phalanxes of state-of-the-art artillery and tanks. Then come the nuclear missiles. It's an awesome show of strength. But after the missiles comes a straggle of 6 or 7 civilians, unkempt, shabbily dressed, utterly out of place. An aide rushes up to Brezhnev and begs forgiveness. "Comrade Secretary, my apologies. I do not know who these people are or how they've come into our parade." "Do not be concerned, comrade," replies Brezhnev. "I am responsible for them. They are our economists, and you have no idea how much damage they can do." Behind the humor was Reagan's long-held distrust of economists who promoted what he saw as destructive government interference in the marketplace. He was, of course, at root devoted to free markets. He wanted to open up the action in the economy. Though his grasp of economics wasn't very deep or sophisticated, he understood the tendency of free markets to self-correct and the fundamental wealth-creating power of capitalism. He trusted Adam Smith's invisible hand to both encourage innovation and produce outcomes that he generally perceived as fair. That's why it sometimes made sense to leave the briefing book closed. Reagan's emphasis on the big picture helped him defeat a president who seemed compelled to micromanage. Years later, I learned that Reagan always worried about being overbriefed by his advisors. In the 1984 campaign, he blamed overbriefing for his poor performance against Mondale in the first televised debate. My involvement with the campaign made me a bit player in Reagan's choice of a running mate, a drama that unfolded at the Republican convention in late July. By then, Reagan had the nomination locked up, but the race against President Carter looked close. Polls showed that the choice of a running mate could be crucial. In particular, a ticket of Ronald Reagan and Gerry Ford would pick up 2 or 3 percentage points, enough to win. I learned this in the midst of the convention, which that year was in Detroit. Reagan had a suite on the 69th floor of the Renaissance Center Plaza Hotel, and on Tuesday of convention week, he called Henry Kissinger and me to his room and asked if we would feel out the former president. He and Ford had been political rivals for years, but they had buried the hatchet several weeks before, when Reagan had gone to visit Ford in Palm Springs. Evidently, the governor had broached the idea of a joint ticket then, and while Ford had said no, he'd also made it clear to Reagan that he wanted to help defeat Jimmy Carter. Reagan told us he had raised the possibility of the vice presidency again with Ford earlier that day, and now he was pulling us in because we'd been among Ford's closest advisors. Kissinger, of course, had been his Secretary of State. Ford was staying in a suite just one floor above Reagan's, and Henry and I called and asked if we could stop by. We met with him and talked briefly that night. The following afternoon, we came back so Henry could present a set of talking points about the vice presidency written by Reagan's counselor Ed Meese and others in the Reagan camp. Because a former president had never served as vice president, they were envisioning an expanded role that would make the job attractive and appropriate for Ford. In their proposal, Ford would be the head of the president's executive office, with power over national security, the federal budget, and more. In effect, while Reagan would be America's chief executive officer, Ford would be its chief operating officer. Personally, I hoped Ford would accept. I felt the nation needed his skills. But while he clearly felt the pull both of duty and of the limelight, Ford was skeptical that a super vice presidency would actually work. For one thing, it raised constitutional questions. The role was clearly beyond what the founders had envisioned. For another thing, he doubted that any president could or should accept a dilution of power in carrying out his oath of office. Also, he was ambivalent about going back to Washington. "I've been out of office 4 years, and I'm having a wonderful life in Palm Springs," he said. Yet he really wanted to help unseat Carter, who he thought was a weak president. There was lots of back and forth between the two camps, and toward the end of the day, Ford told us, "The answer now is still no, but I'll consider it." Rumors of a Reagan-Ford dream ticket, meanwhile, were sweeping the convention floor. When Ford made a previously scheduled appearance on the CBS Evening News, Walter Cronkite asked pointedly about the possibility of a co-presidency. Ford answered with his typical forthrightness. He would never come back as a figurehead vice president, he said. "I have to go there with the belief that I will play a meaningful role across the board in the basic and the crucial and the important decisions." Reportedly, this infuriated Reagan, who was watching. He couldn't believe Ford would discuss their private negotiation on national TV. But by then, I think both men were concluding that to redefine the vice president's role was too important and complex a task to be accomplished on the fly. Henry, in full shuttle diplomacy mode, was hoping to continue the discussions Thursday, but Reagan and Ford both knew that prolonging the uncertainty would hurt Reagan's image. So Ford made his decision. He went down to Reagan's suite around 10 o'clock and told the governor he could help the ticket more by campaigning as an ex-president on Reagan's behalf than as his running mate. "He was a gentleman," Reagan said afterward. "I feel we're friends now." He quickly selected George H.W. Bush as his vice presidential candidate and made the announcement that very night. I didn't expect a role in the new administration, and was not sure I wanted one. Coming into the White House, Reagan had more talented and experienced people than places to put them. That was either a problem or an opportunity, depending on what you did about it. Anderson, who'd been named assistant to the president for domestic policy development, likes to joke that he went to Reagan and Meese, who headed the transition, and said, "We've got these incredible people, but if we don't use them pretty soon, they'll attack us." Instead of dissolving the team that had helped him win, Reagan instituted an advisory group called the Economic Policy Board. George Shultz chaired it, and it included Milton Friedman, Arthur Burns, Bill Simon, me, and several other prominent economists. One of the first cabinet-level officers to be appointed was David Stockman, the director of the budget. Reagan had campaigned on lowering taxes, building up the military, and cutting down the size of government. The strategy before the inauguration was to give Stockman a head start on the budget, so tough cuts could be presented to incoming cabinet members as a fait accompli. Stockman was a brilliant, hungry 34-year-old congressman from rural Michigan who relished being the point man for what came to be called the Reagan Revolution. In speeches, Reagan had compared downsizing the government to applying fatherly discipline. "You know, we can lecture our children about extravagance until we run out of breath, or we can cure their extravagance by simply reducing their allowance." In Stockman's version, this philosophy had a fiercer name. It was called Starving the Beast. I worked closely with Stockman during the transition as he fashioned a budget that was tough as nails, and I was there the day shortly before the inauguration when he presented it to Reagan. The president said, "Just tell me, David, do we treat everyone the same? You have to cut everybody equally nastily." Stockman assured him he had, and Reagan gave his okay. The Economic Policy Board found itself called into action more quickly than anyone expected. The cornerstone of the Reagan tax cuts was a bill that had been proposed by Congressman Jack Kemp and Senator William Roth. It called for a dramatic 3-year, 30% rollback of taxes on both businesses and individuals, and was designed to jolt the economy out of its slump, which was now entering its second year. I believed that if spending was restrained as much as Reagan proposed, and as long as the Federal Reserve continued to enforce strict control of the money supply, the plan was credible, though it would be a hard sell. That was the consensus of the rest of the Economic Board as well. But Stockman and Don Regan, the incoming Treasury Secretary, were having doubts. They were leery of the growing federal deficit, already more than $50 billion a year, and they began quietly telling the president he ought to hold off on any tax cuts. Instead, they wanted him to try getting Congress to cut spending first, then see whether the resulting savings would allow for tax reductions. Whenever this talk of postponement would get intense, George Shultz would summon the Economics Advisory Board to Washington. This happened 5 or 6 times during Reagan's first year. We'd meet in the Roosevelt Room from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. and compare our assessments of the economic outlook. Promptly at 11, the door would open, and in would come Reagan. Our group reported directly to him, and we'd tell him, "Under no circumstances should you delay the tax cut." He'd smile and joke. Shultz and Friedman and others were old friends of his. Regan and Stockman, who were permitted to attend the meetings but were not allowed to take seats at the conference table or to vote, would sit along the wall and smolder. Presently, the session would end, and Reagan would leave, fortified in his resolve to press for his tax cuts. Ultimately, of course, Congress approved a version of his economic plan. But since Congress shied away from the necessary restraints on spending, the deficit remained a huge and growing problem. I played a small role in another presidential decision that first year, not to meddle with the Fed. Reagan was being urged to do so by many people in both parties, including some of his top aides. With double-digit interest rates now entering their third year, people wanted the Fed to expand money supply growth. Not that Reagan could command the chairman of the Fed to do this, but, the theory went, if he were to criticize the Fed publicly, Volcker might feel obliged to ease up. Whenever the question arose, I would tell the president, "Don't pressure the Fed." For one thing, Volcker's policy seemed right. Inflation did seem to be slowly coming under control. For another thing, open disagreement between the White House and the Fed could only shake investors' confidence, slowing the recovery. Volcker didn't make things easy for the new president. The two men had never met, and a few weeks after taking office, Reagan wanted to get acquainted. In order to avoid the appearance of summoning the Fed chairman to the White House, he asked if he could come see Volcker at the Fed, only to have Volcker send back word that such a visit would be inappropriate. I was perplexed. I did not see how a visit by the president could compromise the Fed's independence. Nevertheless, Reagan persisted, and finally Volcker allowed that he would be willing to meet at the Treasury Department. The president's opening line at their lunch in Don Regan's office became part of the Reagan legend. He said mildly to Volcker, "I'm curious. People are asking why we need a Fed at all." I am told Volcker's jaw dropped. He had to regroup before coming back with a persuasive defense of the institution. This evidently satisfied Reagan, who went back to being his amiable self. He had communicated that the Federal Reserve Act was subject to change. The two men cooperated quietly from then on. Reagan gave Volcker the political cover he needed. No matter how much people complained, the president made it his practice never to criticize the Fed. And though Volcker was a Democrat, when his term ended in 1983, Reagan reappointed him. In late 1981, Reagan asked me to take the lead in dealing with a colossal headache that had been building for years. Social Security was running out of money. During the Nixon administration, when the program had seemed flush with reserves, Congress had taken the fateful step of indexing benefits to inflation. As inflation soared through the 1970s, so did the cost of living increases in people's Social Security checks. The system was in such financial straits that an added $200 billion was going to be needed as early as 1983 to keep the program afloat. The long-term prospects looked even worse. Reagan had shied away from talking in any detail about Social Security during his campaign. When the question came up, he'd pledged simply to preserve the system. And no wonder. Social Security is truly the third rail of American politics. There was nothing more explosive than Social Security reform. Everybody knew that no matter how you dressed it up, any solution was in the end going to involve either raising taxes or cutting benefits for a huge and powerful block of voters, or both. Yet the problem was serious, and leaders in both parties understood that something needed to be done, either that or face the likelihood of not being able to mail checks to 36 million senior citizens and disabled Americans. We were getting down to the wire. Reagan's opening gambit in his first budget was to propose a $2.3 billion reduction in Social Security outlays. That raised such a storm of protest that he was forced to back down. 3 months later, he came back harder, with a reform proposal that would cut $46 billion in benefits over 5 years. But it was clear that a bipartisan compromise was the only hope. Thus, the Greenspan Commission was born. Most commissions, of course, don't do anything. But Jim Baker, the architect of this one, believed passionately that government could be made to work. The commission he built was a virtuoso demonstration of how to get things done in Washington. It was a bipartisan group, with 5 members chosen by the White House, 5 by the Senate Majority Leader, and 5 by the Speaker of the House. Virtually every commissioner was an all-star in his or her field. There were congressional heavy hitters like Bob Dole, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Pat Moynihan, the brilliant maverick senator from New York, and Claude Pepper, the outspoken 81-year-old congressman from Florida who was a senior citizens icon. Lane Kirkland, the head of the AFL-CIO, was a member and became a close friend. So was Alexander Trowbridge, the head of the National Association of Manufacturers. House Speaker Tip O'Neill appointed the top Democrat, Bob Ball, who had run the Social Security Administration for LBJ, and the president appointed me as chairman. I won't go into the intricacies of demographics and finance we mastered, or the policy debates and hearings that ate up more than a year. I ran the commission in the spirit that Jim Baker had envisioned, aiming for an effective bipartisan compromise. We took 4 key steps to make the whole thing work, which I'll mention because I've used variations of them ever since. The first was to limit the problem. In this case, it meant not taking up the issue of the future funding of Medicare. While technically part of Social Security, Medicare was a far more complex problem, and trying to solve both could mean we would do neither. The second was to get everyone to agree on the problem's numerical dimensions. As Pat Moynihan later put it, "You're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts." When it was clear that a long-term shortfall was real, commission members lost their ability to demagogue. they had to support cuts in benefits and/or support a rise in revenues. Reverting to the cop-out of financing Social Security from the federal government's general revenues was adamantly ruled out early by Pepper, who worried it would cause Social Security to become a welfare program. The third smart tactic came from Baker. If we wanted a compromise to succeed, he argued, we had to bring everybody along. So we made a point of keeping both Reagan and O'Neill in the loop as we worked. It became Bob Ball's job to inform O'Neill, and my job and Baker's to inform the president. Our fourth move was to agree among the commissioners that once a compromise was reached, we would stand firm against any amendments being imposed by either party. I later told reporters, if you take pieces out of the package, you will lose the consensus and the whole agreement starts to unravel. We published our report in January 1983. When it was finally time to present the reform proposals to Congress, Ball and I resolved to testify side by side. Whenever a Republican asked a question, I would answer it, and whenever a Democrat asked a question, he would answer it, which is just what we tried to do, though the senators didn't entirely cooperate. Diverse as our commission was, we found ways to agree. What brought together men like Claude Pepper and the head of the manufacturers was the care we took to spread the burden. The Social Security amendments, which Reagan ultimately signed into law in 1983, involved paying for everyone. Employers had to absorb further increases in the payroll tax. Employees faced higher taxes too, and in some cases saw the date when they could anticipate receiving benefits pushed further into the future. Retirees had to accept postponement of cost of living increases, and wealthier retirees began having their benefits taxed. But by doing all this, we succeeded in funding Social Security over the 75-year planning period that is conventional for social insurance programs. Moynihan, with his usual eloquence, declared, I have the strongest feeling that we all have won. What we have won is a resolution of the terrible fear in this country that the Social Security system was, like a chain letter, something of a fraud. As all this was still unfolding in 1983, I was in my office one day in New York, poring over demographic projections, when the telephone rang. It was Andrea Mitchell, a reporter for NBC. I've got some questions about the president's budget proposals, she said. She explained that she'd been trying to figure out whether the Reagan administration's latest fiscal policy assumptions were credible, and that David Gergen, the assistant to the White House communications chief, had suggested my name. She told me Gergen had said, If you really want to know about the economy, why don't you call Alan Greenspan? He knows more than anybody. I'll bet you say that to all the economists, I replied. But sure, let's talk. I'd noticed Andrea on NBC newscasts. She was a White House correspondent. I thought she was very articulate and that her voice had the nicest authoritative resonance. Also, I'd noted, she was a very good-looking woman. We talked that day and a few more times, and soon I became a regular source. Over the next 2 years, Andrea would phone whenever she had a big economic story in the works. I liked the way she handled the material on TV. Even when the issues were too complex to present in their full technical detail, she would find the crux of the story, and she was accurate with the facts. In 1984, Andrea asked if I'd come with her to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where reporters invite their sources. I had to tell her that I'd already agreed to go with Barbara Walters, but I added, Do you ever get to New York? Maybe we could have dinner. It took another 8 months before we could connect. It was an election year, and Andrea was extremely busy through November when Reagan defeated Mondale in a landslide. Finally, when the holidays arrived, we scheduled a date, and I made a reservation at Le Perigot, my favorite restaurant in New York, for December 28th. It was a snowy night, and Andrea rushed in late, looking very beautiful, if a bit disheveled after a day of reporting the news and trying to hail cabs in the snow. That night I discovered she was a former musician like me. She'd played violin in the Westchester Symphony. We loved the same music. Her record collection was similar to mine. She liked baseball. But mainly, we shared an intense interest in current affairs, strategic, political, military, diplomatic. There was no shortage of things to talk about. It might not be everybody's idea of first date conversation, but at the restaurant we ended up discussing monopolies. I told her I'd written an essay on the subject and invited her back to my apartment to read it. She teases me about that now, saying, What, you didn't have any etchings? But we did go to my apartment, and I showed her this essay I'd written on antitrust for Ayn Rand. She read it, and we discussed it. To this day, Andrea claims I was giving her a test. But it wasn't that. I was doing everything I could think of to keep her around. For much of Reagan's second term, Andrea was my main reason to go to Washington. I stayed in touch with people in the government, but my focus was almost entirely in the business and economics world of New York. As business economics matured as a profession, I'd gotten deeply involved in its organizations. I'd served as president of the National Association of Business Economists and as chairman of the Conference of Business Economists and was slated to become chairman of the Economic Club of New York, the financial and business world's equivalent of the Council on Foreign Relations. Townsend Greenspan itself had changed. Large economics firms with names like DRI and Wharton Econometrics had grown up to supply much of the basic data needed by business planners. Computer modeling had become much more widespread, and many corporations had economists of their own. I'd experimented with diversifying into investment and pension fund consulting, but while those ventures made money, they weren't as lucrative as corporate consulting. Also, more projects meant more employees, which meant more of my time had to be spent managing the business. Ultimately, I concluded that the best course was to focus exclusively on what I did best, solve interesting analytical puzzles for sophisticated clients who needed answers and could pay high-end fees. So, in the second half of the Reagan administration, I planned to scale back Townsend Greenspan. But before I could implement those plans, in March 1987, I received a phone call from Jim Baker. Baker was by this time Treasury Secretary. After an intense 4 years as White House Chief of Staff, he'd made an unusual job swap, trading posts in 1985 with Don Regan. Jim and I had been friends since the Ford days, and I'd helped him prepare for his Senate confirmation hearing the spring he took over at Treasury. He had his assistant call to ask if I could come to Washington for a meeting at his house. This struck me as odd. Why not meet at his office? But I agreed. The next morning, a Washington driver delivered me to Baker's nice old Georgian colonial on an elegant stretch of Foxhall Road. I was surprised to find waiting for me not only Jim, but also Howard Baker, President Reagan's current chief of staff. Howard got right to the point. "Paul Volcker may be leaving this summer when his term runs out," he began. "We're not in a position to offer you the job, but we'd like to know, if it were to be offered, would you accept?" I was briefly at a loss for words. Until a few years before, I'd never thought of myself as a potential Fed chairman. In 1983, as Volcker's first term was ending, I'd been startled when one of the Wall Street firms conducted a straw poll of who might replace Volcker if he were to leave, and my name turned up on top of the list. As close as I was to Arthur Burns, the Fed had always been a black box to me. Having watched him struggle, I did not feel equipped to do the job. Setting interest rates for an entire economy seemed to involve so much more than I knew. The job seemed amorphous, the type of task in which it is very easy to be wrong even if you have virtually full knowledge. Forecasting a complex economy such as ours is not a 90-10 proposition. You're very fortunate if you can do 60-40. All the same, the challenge was too great to turn down. I told the Bakers that if the job were offered, I would accept. I had plenty of time to get cold feet. Over the next 2 months, Jim Baker would phone to say things like, "It's still under discussion," or "Volcker is thinking about whether he wants to stay." I felt alternately fascinated by the possibility and a little unsettled. It wasn't until just before Memorial Day that Baker phoned and said, "Paul has decided to leave." He asked if I was still interested, and I said yes. He said, "You'll be getting a call from the president in a few days." 2 days later, I was at my orthopedist's office, and the nurse came in to say the White House was on the line. It had taken the call a few minutes to get through because the receptionist had thought it was a prank. They let me use the doctor's private office to take the call. I picked up the phone and heard that familiar, easy voice. Ronald Reagan said, "Alan, I want you to be my chairman of the Federal Reserve Board." I told him I would be honored to do so. Then we chatted a bit. I thanked him and hung up. As I stepped back into the hall, the nurse seemed very concerned. "Are you all right?" she asked. "You look like you've gotten bad news." Chapter 5. Black Monday. I'd scrutinized the economy every working day for decades and had visited the Fed scores of times. Nevertheless, when I was appointed chairman, I knew I'd have a lot to learn. That was reinforced the minute I walked in the door. The first person to greet me was Dennis Buckley, a security agent who would stay with me throughout my tenure. He addressed me as Mr. Chairman. Without thinking, I said, "Don't be silly. Everybody calls me Alan." He gently explained that calling the chairman by his first name was just not the way things were done at the Fed. So, Alan became Mr. Chairman. The staff, I next learned, had prepared a series of intensive tutorials, diplomatically labeled one-person seminars, in which I was the student. This meant that for the next 10 days, senior people from the professional staff gathered in the board's fourth-floor conference room and taught me my job. I learned about sections of the Federal Reserve Act I never knew existed, and for which I was now responsible. The staff taught me arcana about banking regulation that, having been a director of both J.P. Morgan and Bowery Savings, I was amazed I'd never encountered. Of course, the Fed had experts in every dimension of domestic and international economics, as well as the capability to call in data from everywhere, privileged access that I was eager to explore. Though I'd been a corporate director, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, as it is formally known, was an order of magnitude larger than anything I'd ever run. Today, the Federal Reserve Board staff includes some 2,000 employees and has an annual budget of nearly $300 million. Fortunately, running it wasn't my job. The long-standing practice is to designate one of the other board members as the administrative governor to oversee day-to-day operations. There is also a staff director for management who acts as a chief of staff. This way, only issues that are out of the ordinary or that might spark public or congressional interest are brought to the chairman, such as the massive challenge of upgrading the international payment system for the turn of the millennium. Otherwise, he is free to concentrate on the economy, just what I was eager to do. The Fed chairman has less unilateral power than the title might suggest. By statute, I controlled only the agenda for the Board of Governors meetings. The board decided all other matters by majority rule, and the chairman was just one vote among seven. Also, I was not automatically the chairman of the Federal Open Market Committee, the powerful group that controls the federal funds rate, the primary lever of U.S. monetary policy. When the FOMC changes this rate, the committee directs the Fed's so-called open market desk in New York to either buy or sell Treasury securities, often billions of dollars worth in a day. Selling by the Fed acts as a brake, withdrawing from the economy the money received in the transaction and pushing short-term interest rates higher, while buying does the reverse. Today, the Fed funds rate that the FOMC is seeking is publicly announced, but in those days it wasn't. So Wall Street firms would assign Fed watchers to divine changes in monetary policy from the actions of our traders or changes in our weekly reported balance sheet. The FOMC is made up of the 7 board governors and the presidents of the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks. Only 5 can vote at any one time, and it too makes decisions by majority rule. While the board chairman is traditionally the chair of the FOMC, he or she must be elected each year by the members, and they are free to choose someone else. I expected precedent to prevail, but I was always aware that a revolt of the 6 other governors could remove all of my authority, except writing the board agendas. I quickly got hold of Don Cohn, the FOMC secretary, and had him walk me through the protocols of a meeting. Don, who had proved to be the most effective policy advisor in the Fed system during my 18 years, is now vice chairman of the board. The FOMC held its meetings in secret, so I had no idea what the standard agenda or timetable was, who spoke first, who deferred to whom, how to conduct a vote, and so on. The committee also had its own lingo that I needed to get comfortable with. For example, when the FOMC wanted to authorize the chairman to notch up the Fed funds rate if necessary before the next regular meeting, it did not say, "You may raise interest rates if you decide you have to." Instead, it voted to give an asymmetric directive toward tightening. For the record, even as I learned Fed speak, I would joke to the staff, "Whatever happened to the English language?" I was scheduled to run one of those meetings the following week, on August 18th, so I was a highly motivated student. Andrea still jokes about my coming over to her house that weekend to curl up with Robert's Rules of Order. I felt a real need to hit the ground running because I knew the Fed would soon face big decisions. The Reagan-era expansion was well into its fourth year, and while the economy was thriving, it was also showing clear signs of instability. Since the beginning of the year, when the Dow Jones Industrial Average had risen through 2,000 for the first time, the stock market had run up more than 40%. Now it stood at more than 2,700, and Wall Street was in a speculative froth. Something similar was happening in commercial real estate. The economic indicators, meanwhile, were far from encouraging. Huge government deficits under Reagan had caused the national debt to the public to almost triple, from just over $700 billion at the start of his presidency to more than $2 trillion at the end of fiscal year 1988. The dollar was falling, and people were worried about America losing its competitive edge. The media were full of alarmist talk about the growing Japanese threat. Consumer prices, which had gone up just 1.9% in 1986, were rising at nearly double that rate in my first days in office. Though 3.6% inflation was far milder than the double-digit nightmare people remembered from the 1970s, once inflation begins, it usually grows. We were in danger of forfeiting the victory that had been gained at such great misery and cost under Paul Volcker. These were vast economic issues, of course, far beyond the power of the Fed alone to resolve. Yet the worst course would be to sit idly by. I thought a rate increase would be prudent, but the Fed hadn't raised interest rates for 3 years. Hiking them now would be a big deal. Anytime the Fed changes direction, it can rattle the markets. The risk in clamping down during a stock market surge is especially acute. It can pop the bubble of investor confidence, and if that scares people enough, can trigger a severe economic contraction. Though I was friendly with many of the committee members, I knew better than to think that a chairman who had been around for a week could walk into a meeting and shape a consensus on such a risky decision. So I did not propose a rate increase. I simply listened to what the others had to say. The 18 committee members, there was one vacancy on the Federal Reserve Board, were all seasoned central bankers and economists, and as we went around the table comparing assessments of the economy, it was apparent that they too were concerned. Jerry Corrigan, the gruff president of the New York Fed, said we ought to raise rates. Bob Perry, the Fed president from San Francisco, reported that his district was seeing good growth, high optimism, and full employment, all reasons to be leery of inflation. Cy Keen from Chicago agreed, reporting that the Midwest's factories were running near full capacity and that even the farm outlook had improved. Tom Melzer of the St. Louis Fed told of how even the shoe factories in that district were operating at 100%. Bob Forrestal from Atlanta described how his staff had been surprised at the strength of employment figures even in chronically depressed sections of the South. I think everyone walked away persuaded that the Fed would have to raise rates soon. The next opportunity to do so was 2 weeks later, on September 4th, at a meeting of the Board of Governors. The Board controls the other main lever of monetary policy, the discount rate at which the Federal Reserve lends to depository institutions. This rate generally moves in lockstep with the rate on Fed funds. Prior to the scheduled board meeting, I spent a few days working my way up and down the corridor, seeking out the governors in their offices, building consensus. The meeting, when it came, moved quickly to a vote. The rate increase, from 5.5% to 6%, was approved by the governors unanimously. To subdue inflationary pressures, we were trying to slow the economy by making money more expensive to borrow. There's no way to predict how severely the markets will respond to such a move, especially when investors are gripped with speculative fervor. I couldn't help but remember accounts I'd read of the physicists at Alamogordo the first time they detonated an atom bomb. Would the bomb fizzle? Would it work the way they hoped? Or would the chain reaction somehow go out of control and set the Earth's atmosphere on fire? After the meeting ended, I had to fly to New York. From there, I was scheduled to leave that weekend for Switzerland, where I was attending my first meeting of the central bankers of the 10 leading industrialized nations. The Fed's hope was that the key markets, stocks, futures, currency, bonds, would take the change in stride, maybe with stocks cooling off slightly and the dollar strengthening. I kept calling back to the office to check how the markets were responding. The sky did not catch fire that day. Stocks dipped, banks upped their prime lending rates in line with our move, and the financial world, as we'd hoped, noted that the Fed had begun acting to quell inflation. Perhaps the most dramatic impact was reflected in a New York Times headline a few days later, "Wall Street's Sharpest Rise, Anxiety." I was finally allowing myself to breathe a sigh of relief when a message reached me from Paul Volcker. He knew exactly what I'd been going through. "Congratulations," it read. "You are now a central banker." I did not for a minute think we were out of the woods. Signs of trouble in the economy continued to mount. Slowing growth and a further weakening of the dollar put Wall Street on edge as investors and institutions began confronting the likelihood that billions of dollars in speculative bets would never pay off. In early October, that fear turned to near panic. The stock market skidded by 6% the first week, then another 12% the second week. The worst loss was on Friday, October 16th, when the Dow Jones average dropped by 108 points. Since the end of September, nearly $500 billion of paper wealth had evaporated in the stock market alone, not to mention the losses in currency and other markets. The decline was so stunning that Time magazine devoted 2 full pages to the stock market that week, under the headline, "Wall Street's October Massacre." I knew that from a historical perspective, this correction was not nearly the most severe. The market slump in 1970 had been proportionally twice as large, and the Great Depression had wiped out fully 80% of the market's value. But given how poorly the week had ended, everyone was worried about what might happen when the markets opened again on Monday. I was supposed to fly on Monday afternoon to Dallas, where on Tuesday I was to speak at the American Bankers Association convention, my first major speech as chairman. Monday morning I conferred with the Board of Governors, and we agreed that I should make the trip, lest it seem that the Fed was in a panic. The market that morning opened weakly, and by the time I had to leave it looked awful, down by more than 200 points. There was no telephone on the airplane, so the first thing I did when I arrived was to ask one of the people who greeted me from the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, "How did the stock market finally go?" He said, "It was down 508. Usually when someone says 508, he means 5.08, so the market had dropped only 5 points. "Great," I said. "What a terrific rally." But as I said it, I saw that the expression on his face was not shared relief. In fact, the market had crashed by 508 points, a 22.5% drop, the biggest one-day loss in history, bigger even than the one on the day that started the Great Depression, Black Friday 1929. I went straight to the hotel, where I stayed on the phone into the night. Manley Johnson, the vice chairman of the Fed's board, had set up a crisis desk in my office in Washington, and we held a series of calls and teleconferences to map out plans. Jerry Corrigan filled me in on conversations he'd had in New York with Wall Street executives and officials at the stock exchange. Cy Keene had talked to the heads of the Chicago Commodities Futures Exchanges and trading firms. Bob Perry in San Francisco reported what he was hearing from the chiefs of the savings and loan industry, who were mainly based on the West Coast. The Fed's job during a stock market panic is to ward off financial paralysis, a chaotic state in which businesses and banks stop making the payments they owe each other and the economy grinds to a halt. To the senior people on the phone with me that night, the urgency and gravity of the situation was apparent. Even if the markets got no worse, the system would be reeling for weeks. We started exploring ways we might have to supply liquidity if major institutions ran short of cash. Not all of our younger people understood the seriousness of the crisis, however. As we discussed what public statement the Fed should make, one of them suggested, "Maybe we're overreacting. Why not wait a few days and see what happens?" Though I was new at this job, I'd been a student of financial history for too long to think that made any sense. It was the one moment I spoke sharply to anybody that night. "We don't need to wait to see what happens," I told him. "We know what's going to happen." Then I backed up a little and explained, "You know what people say about getting shot? You feel like you've been punched, but the trauma is such that you don't feel the pain right away. In 24 or 48 hours, we're going to be feeling a lot of pain." As the discussion ended, it was clear that the next day would be full of major decisions. Jerry Corrigan made a point of telling me solemnly, "Alan, you're it. The whole thing is on your shoulders." Jerry is a tough character, and I couldn't tell whether he meant this as encouragement or as a challenge for the new chairman. I merely said, "Thank you, Dr. Corrigan." I was not inclined to panic, because I understood the nature of the problems we would face. Still, when I hung up the phone around midnight, I wondered if I'd be able to sleep. That would be the real test. "Now we're going to see what you're made of," I told myself. I went to bed, and I'm proud to say I slept for a good 5 hours. Early the next morning, as we were honing the language of the Fed's public statement, the hotel operator interrupted with a call from the White House. It was Howard Baker, President Reagan's chief of staff. Having known Howard a long time, I acted as though nothing unusual were going on. "Good morning, Senator," I said. "What can I do for you?" "Help," he said in mock plaintiveness. "Where are you?"
"In Dallas," I said. "Is something bothering you?"
Handling the administration's response to a Wall Street crisis is normally the job of the Treasury Secretary. But Jim Baker was in Europe trying to make his way back, and Howard didn't want to deal with this one on his own. I agreed to cancel my speech and return to Washington. I'd been inclined to do so anyway because in the light of the 508-point market drop, going back seemed the best way to assure the bankers that the Fed was taking matters seriously. Baker sent a military executive jet to pick me up. The markets that morning gyrated wildly. Manley Johnson sat in our makeshift operations center giving me the play-by-play while I was airborne. After I got in a car at Andrews Air Force Base, he told me the New York Stock Exchange had called to notify us it was planning to shut down in 1 hour. Trading on key stocks had stalled for lack of buyers. "That'll blow it for everybody," I said. "If they close, we've got a real catastrophe on our hands." Shutting down a market during a crash only compounds investors' pain. As scary as their losses on paper may seem, as long as the market stays open, investors always know that they can get out. But take away the exit, and you exacerbate the fear. To restore trading afterward is extraordinarily hard, because no one knows what prices should be. No one wants to be the first to bid. The resuscitation process can take many days, and the risk is that in the meantime the entire financial system will stall and the economy will suffer a crippling shock. There wouldn't have been much we could do to stop the executives at the exchange, but the marketplace saved us by itself. Within those 60 minutes, enough buyers materialized that the NYSE decided to shelve its plan. The next 36 hours were intense. I joked that I felt like a seven-armed paper hanger, going from one phone to another, talking to the stock exchange, the Chicago futures exchanges, and the various Federal Reserve presidents. My most harrowing conversations were with financiers and bankers I'd known for years, major players from very large companies around the country whose voices were tightened by fear. These were men who had built up wealth and social status over long careers and now found themselves looking into the abyss. Your judgment is less than perfect when you're scared. Calm down, I kept telling them. It's containable. And I would remind them to look beyond the emergency to where their long-term business interest might lie. The Fed attacked the crisis on two fronts. Our first challenge was Wall Street. We had to convince giant trading firms and investment banks, many of which were reeling from losses, not to pull back from doing business. Our public statement early that morning had been painstakingly worded to hint that the Fed would provide a safety net for banks in the expectation that they, in turn, would help support other financial companies. It was as short and concise as the Gettysburg Address, I thought, although possibly not as stirring. The Federal Reserve, consistent with its responsibilities as the nation's central bank, affirmed today its readiness to serve as a source of liquidity to support the economic and financial system. But as long as the markets continued to function, we had no wish to prop up companies with cash. Jerry Corrigan was the hero in this effort. It was his job as head of the New York Fed to convince the players on Wall Street to keep lending and trading, to stay in the game. A Jesuit-educated protege of Volcker's, he'd been a central banker for his entire career. There was no one more streetwise or better suited to be the Fed's chief enforcer. Jerry had the dominant personality necessary to jawbone financiers, yet he understood that even in a crisis, the Fed must exercise restraint. Simply ordering a bank to make a loan, say, would be an abuse of government power and would damage the functioning of the market. Instead, the gist of Jerry's message to the banker had to be, "We're not telling you to lend. All we ask is that you consider the overall interests of your business. Just remember that people have long memories, and if you shut off credit to a customer just because you're a little nervous about him, but with no concrete reason, he's going to remember that." That week, Corrigan had dozens of conversations along these lines, and though I never knew the details, some of those phone calls must have been very tough.
I'm sure he bit off a few earlobes. As all this was going on, we were careful to keep supplying liquidity to the system. The FOMC ordered the traders at the New York Fed to buy billions of dollars of Treasury securities on the open market. This had the effect of putting more money into circulation and lowering short-term rates. Though we'd been tightening interest rates before the crash, we were now easing them to help keep the economy moving. Despite our best efforts, there were a half dozen near disasters, mostly involving the payment system. A lot of transactions during the business day on Wall Street aren't made simultaneously. Companies will do business with one another's customers, for instance, and then settle up at day's end. On Wednesday morning, Goldman Sachs was scheduled to make a $700 million payment to Continental Illinois Bank in Chicago, but initially withheld payment pending receipt of expected funds from other sources. Then Goldman thought better of it and made the payment. Had Goldman withheld such a large sum, it would have set off a cascade of defaults across the market. Subsequently, a senior Goldman official confided to me that had the firm anticipated the difficulties of the ensuing weeks, it would not have paid. And in future such crises, he suspected, Goldman would have second thoughts about making such unrequited payments. We also went to work on the political front. I spent an hour Tuesday at the Treasury Department as soon as Jim Baker returned. He'd been able to catch the Concorde. We huddled in his office with Howard Baker and other officials. President Reagan's initial reaction to Wall Street's calamity on Monday had been to speak optimistically about the economy. "Steady as she goes," he'd said, later adding, "I don't think anyone should panic because all the economic indicators are solid." This was meant to be reassuring, but in the light of events sounded disturbingly like Herbert Hoover declaring after Black Friday that the economy was sound and prosperous. Tuesday afternoon, we met with Reagan at the White House to suggest he try a different tack. The most constructive response, Jim Baker and I argued, would be to offer to cooperate with Congress on cutting the deficit, since that was one of the long-term economic risks upsetting Wall Street. Even though Reagan had been at loggerheads with the Democratic majority, he agreed that this made sense. That afternoon, he told reporters that he would consider any budget proposal Congress put forward, short of cutting Social Security. Though this overture never led to anything, it did help calm the markets. We manned the operations center around the clock. We tracked markets in Japan and Europe. Early each morning, we'd collect stock quotes on U.S. companies trading on European bourses and synthesize our own Dow Jones Industrial Average to get a preview of what the New York markets were likely to do when they opened. It took well over a week for all the crises to play out, though most of them were hidden from public view. Days after the crash, for example, the Chicago options market nearly collapsed when its biggest trading firm ran short of cash. The Chicago Fed helped engineer a solution to that one. Gradually, though, prices in the various markets stabilized, and by the start of November, the members of the crisis management team returned to their regular work. Contrary to everyone's fears, the economy held firm, actually growing at a 2% annual rate in the first quarter of 1988 and at an accelerated 5% rate in the second quarter. By early 1988, the Dow had stabilized at around 2,000, back where it had been at the beginning of 1987, and stocks resumed a much more modest and more sustainable upward path. Economic growth entered its fifth consecutive year. This was no consolation to the speculators who had lost their shirts, or to the scores of small brokerage houses that failed, but ordinary people hadn't been hurt. In retrospect, it was an early manifestation of the economic resilience that would figure so prominently in the coming years. The Federal Reserve and the White House are not automatically allies. In giving the Fed its modern mandate in 1935, Congress took great care to shield it from the influence of the political process. While the governors are all appointed by the president, their positions are semi-permanent. Board members serve terms of 14 years, longer than any appointees except the justices of the Supreme Court. The chairmanship itself is a 4-year appointment, but the chairman can do little without the votes of the other board members. And while the Fed must report twice a year to Congress, it controls its own purse strings by funding itself with interest income from the Treasury securities and other assets it holds. All this frees the Fed to focus on its statutory mission, putting in place the monetary conditions needed for maximum sustainable long-term growth and employment. In the view of the Federal Reserve and most economists, A necessary condition for maximum sustainable economic growth is stable prices. In practice, this means Federal Reserve policies that contain inflationary pressures beyond the current election cycle. No wonder politicians often find the Fed a hindrance. Their better selves may want to focus on America's long-term prosperity, but they are far more subject to constituents' immediate demands. That's inevitably reflected in their economic policy preferences. If the economy is expanding, they want it to expand faster. If they see an interest rate, they want it to be lower. And the Fed's monetary discipline interferes. As William McChesney Martin, Jr., a legendary chairman in the 1950s and 1960s, is alleged to have put it, "The Fed's role is to order the punch bowl removed just when the party was really warming up." You could hear that frustration in the voice of Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush in spring 1988 as he campaigned for the Republican presidential nomination. He told reporters that he had a word of caution for the Fed. "I wouldn't want to see them step over some line that would ratchet down, tighten down on the economic growth." In fact, tightening was just what we were doing. Once it became clear that the stock market crash had not seriously damaged the economy, the FOMC had started inching up the Fed funds rate in March. We'd done so because, again, signs were accumulating that inflation pressures were rising and the long Reagan-era boom had maxed out. Factories were full, and joblessness was at its lowest level in 8 years. This tightening proceeded into the summer, and by August it was necessary to raise the discount rate, too. Since the discount rate, unlike the Fed funds rate, was publicly announced, raising it was much more politically explosive. Fed officials called such a move ringing the gong. The timing for the Bush campaign could not have been worse. Bush wanted to piggyback on Reagan's success, and he was trailing the Democratic contender, Michael Dukakis, by as much as 17 points in the polls. The vice president's campaign staff was hypersensitive to any news that might point to a slowing economy or otherwise dim the luster of the administration. So when we voted to raise the rate just a few days before the Republican convention, we understood that people were going to be upset. I'm a believer in delivering bad news in person, privately, and in advance, especially in Washington, where officials hate to be blindsided and need time to decide what they want to say publicly. I don't enjoy doing it, but there's no alternative if you want to have a relationship thereafter. So as soon as we voted, I left the office and drove over to the Treasury Department to see Jim Baker. He had just announced he was leaving his job as Secretary of the Treasury to become Chief of Staff of the Bush campaign. Jim was an old friend, and as Treasury Secretary, he needed to be told. As we sat down in his office, I caught his eye and said, "I'm sure you're not going to be happy about this, but after a long discussion of all the factors, I listed a few, we arrived at a decision to raise the discount rate. It's going to be announced in an hour." The increase, I added, was not the usual 0.25 percentage point, but twice that, from 6% to 6.5%. Baker sat back in his chair and jabbed his fist into his stomach. "You've hit me right here," he growled. "I'm sorry, Jim," I said. Then he cut loose and lambasted me and the Fed for not being responsive to the real needs of the country and expressed whatever other angry thoughts came into his head. Having been friends for a while, I knew this tirade was just an act. So after a minute, when he paused for air, I smiled at him. Then he laughed. "I know you had to do it," he said. A few days later, he publicly endorsed the rate increase as essential for the long-term stability of the system. "In the medium and long term, it will be a very good thing for the economy," he added. When George Bush won that fall, I hoped the Fed and his administration would get along. Everybody knew that whoever came in after Reagan would face big economic challenges, not just an eventual downturn in the business cycle, but whopping deficits and the rapidly mounting national debt. I thought Bush had upped the ante substantially when he declared in his acceptance speech at the Republican convention, "Read my lips, no new taxes." It was a memorable line, but at some point he was going to have to tackle the deficit, and he tied one hand behind his back. People were surprised by the thoroughness with which the new administration replaced Reagan appointees. My friend Martin Anderson, who had long since shifted out of Washington back to the Hoover Institution in California, joked that Bush fired more Republicans than Dukakis would have. But I told him it didn't bother me. It was a new president's prerogative, and the moves did not affect the Fed. Besides, the senior economic team coming in, Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady, Budget Director Richard Darman, CEA Chairman Michael Boskin, and others, were longtime professional acquaintances and friends of mine. Jim Baker, of course, moved up to become Secretary of State. My main concern, shared by many senior people within the Fed, was that the new administration attacked the deficit right away, while the economy was still strong enough to absorb the shock of cuts in federal spending. Big deficits have an insidious effect. When the government overspends, it must borrow to balance its books. It borrows by selling treasury securities, which siphons away capital that could otherwise be invested in the private economy. Our deficits had been running so high, well over $150 billion a year on average for 5 years, that we were undermining the economy. I highlighted this problem just after the election, testifying before the National Economic Commission, a bipartisan group Reagan had set up in the wake of the 1987 crash. The deficit was no longer a mañana problem, I told them. The long run is rapidly becoming the short run. If we do not act promptly, the effects will be increasingly felt, and with some immediacy. Unsurprisingly, because of Bush's no new taxes pledge, the commission ended in a stalemate, with the Republicans arguing that spending should be cut and the Democrats arguing to raise taxes, and it never had any effect. I quickly found myself in the same public conflict with President Bush that we'd had during the campaign. In January, I testified to the House Banking Committee that inflation risks were still high enough that Fed policy would be to err on the side of restrictiveness rather than stimulus. The next day, with reporters, the president challenged this approach. "I do not want to see us move so strongly against inflation that we impede growth," he said. Normally, such differences would get aired and resolved behind the scenes. I'd been looking toward building the same collaborative relationship with the White House that I'd seen during the Ford administration, and that I knew had existed at times between Reagan and Paul Volcker. It was not to be. Great things happened on George Bush's watch: the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Cold War, a clear victory in the Persian Gulf, and the negotiation of the NAFTA agreement to free North American trade. But the economy was his Achilles heel, and as a result, we ended up with a terrible relationship. He faced a worsening trade deficit and the politically damaging phenomenon of factories moving overseas. The pressure to cut the federal deficit finally forced him, in July 1990, to accept a budget compromise in which he broke his no-new-taxes pledge. Just days later came Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. The ensuing Gulf War proved to be great for his approval ratings, but the crisis also threw the economy into the recession we'd been worried about, as oil prices rose and uncertainty hurt consumer confidence. Worse still, the recovery, which began in early 1991, was unusually slow and anemic. Most of these events were beyond anyone's control, but they still made the economy stupid an effective way for Bill Clinton to beat Bush in the 1992 election, despite the fact that the economy during that year had grown by 4.1%. Two factors greatly complicated the economic picture. The first was the collapse of America's thrift industry, which put a big, unexpected drain on the federal budget. Savings and loans, which had been instituted in their modern form to finance the building of the suburbs after World War II, had been failing in waves for a decade. The inflation of the 70s, compounded by mismanaged deregulation and ultimately fraud, did hundreds of them in. As originally conceived, an S&L was a simple mortgage machine, not much different from the Bailey Building and Loan run by Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. Typically, customers would deposit money in passbook savings accounts, which paid only 3% interest but were federally insured. Then the S&L would lend out those funds in the form of 30-year mortgages at 6% interest. As a result, S&Ls for decades were dependable moneymakers, and the thrift industry grew huge, with more than 3,600 institutions and $1.5 trillion in assets by 1987. But inflation spelled doom for this tidy state of affairs. It drove both short-term and long-term interest rates sharply higher, putting the S&Ls in a terrible squeeze. For the typical S&L, the cost of deposits soared immediately, but because the mortgage portfolios turned over only slowly, revenues lagged. Soon many S&Ls were in the red, and by 1989, the great majority were technically insolvent. If they'd sold all their loans, they wouldn't have had enough money to pay off all their depositors. Congress tried repeatedly to prop up the industry, but mainly succeeded in making the problem worse. Just in time for the building boom of the Reagan era, it increased the level of taxpayer-funded deposit insurance from $40,000 to $100,000 per account, and relaxed the restrictions on the kinds of loans SNLs could make. Before long, emboldened SNL executives were financing skyscrapers and resorts and thousands of other projects that in many cases they barely understood, and they were often losing their shirts. Others took advantage of the loosened rules to commit fraud, most notoriously Charles Keating, a West Coast entrepreneur who was ultimately sent to prison for racketeering and fraud for having misled investors through sham real estate transactions and the sale of worthless junk bonds. Salesmen at Keating's Lincoln Savings were also said to have talked unsophisticated people into shifting their savings from passbook accounts into risky, uninsured ventures controlled by him. When the business collapsed, cleaning up the mess cost taxpayers $3.4 billion, and as many as 25,000 bond buyers lost an estimated $250 million. The revelation in 1990 that Keating and other SNL executives were major contributors to Senate campaigns made for a full-blown Washington drama. I had a complicated involvement in this mess, not only because of my job, but also because of a study I'd done while still a private consultant. Years before, at Townsend Greenspan, a major law firm representing Keating had hired me to evaluate whether Lincoln was financially healthy enough to be allowed to invest directly in real estate. I'd concluded that with its then highly liquid balance sheet, it could do so safely. This was before Keating undertook dangerous increases in the leveraging of his balance sheet, and long before he was